Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. As an artist who has worked behind the scenes with the prints and drawings collections of the National Gallery of Art for 35 years, Associate Curator Charles Ritchie relishes his unique vantage point for watching artists think. He has an intimate view of everything from the sketching, erasing, and refining at the core of drawing, to studying the sequences of proof impressions that record the development of a print. On March 25, 2019, as part of the Works in Progress series at the National Gallery of Art, Ritchie shares how his own drawing, journal keeping, and printmaking have been influenced by what he's learned. The presentation offers a collection of his observations.
I call this talk Walking Thinking, and we are going to look at five different aspects of, watching thinking, walking thinking, watching thinking, and five different angles on this. First of all, we're going to look at some of my drawing program. I've been sitting at a window in my house for 35 years drawing from that window, watching and thinking. Secondly, I'm going to be talking about my journal keeping. I've been keeping a journal for 42 years, and I kind of stand out myself outside of myself and look at myself through these journals. Third, we're going to look at the printmaking, and printmaking by its nature leaving a trail of proofs, test prints. One watches the artists think. Fourth, we're going to look at my experience curating here at the National Gallery. As prints and drawings curators, I think we're especially positioned to watch artists think. We'll talk about that. Finally, I'd like to summarize with some of my most, a few of my recent works and talk about basically all that I've learned as working a print curator and some of the things that we've talked about here today tied together with recent drawings. This is a watercolor drawing done from my Silver Spring home window. I've been working at this window for 34 years. I had a kind of deja vu when we walked up to our house and I looked out this window. I had been here before the first day. And in a way, it's just been the center of my activity. Looking out the window, watching the seasons change, the changes in the landscape, the subtle changes like moving a light in the house. Let's do a little comparison with a drawing I just finished from exactly the same vantage point, done only during snowstorms at our house over a period of 5 years. So you can see the variety of evidence that I'm using to build these drawings over periods of time. I only like to work in front of the subjects at the time that the activity is manifesting itself. Well, this practice goes way back, like I say, about through 2 years after we moved into the house. I started this drawing. Over a period of 2 years, you can actually see many changes. There were lots of screen porches in those days, and they've been turned into additions to the house. This is ink and wash. I use a lot of different media, changing things up every time I work. Let's compare it with a drawing that was finished about 25 years later. And we take a look, and it was done in graphite wash, which is actually water and graphite powder washed into the particular surface, letting it dry, erasing it, and then drawing back into it. Of course, I worked on top of Conte crayon, layers of Conte crayon, building up to the darkness I wanted. Let's take a focus on a particular area of the composition. In 1987, from the previous drawing, that little oak tree was not much bigger than the redbud and the dogwoods, and by 2011, it had become quite a major tree. You can also see this in another drawing I did. I started it about 3 years after I moved into the house. I originally did it in red ink and very fine point pen, delineating every little aspect of the landscape. I put it up on the wall for about 2 years and suddenly realized I had used fugitive ink. The whole drawing was fading in front of me. So what I decided to do is rather than let it go and call it a disaster, I worked into it in graphite over the years, letting myself work on it. And actually, I haven't closed this drawing. It's a 30-year drawing and going. So I'm still working at this particular landscape. But because I just worked into the drawing at the very beginning with just a little bit of black ink in certain places, you can actually see that original oak tree under all those layers of graphite. Well, I've been doing talks based around my subject for a long time. I've been going around and talking about how this tree is a centerpiece of my work, and I'm going to grow old with it and watch it become a great oak. Well, this September, they cut it down. And I took my sketchbooks out and made sketches of it as it came down in pen and ink. I even did the shadow of how it was no longer on the house anymore in the streetlight. A little self-portrait with me. Got drawings up behind me reflected in the window, and there was this strange empty space. And I thought about it later, hey, maybe that empty space is the space that the tree left. At any rate, this brings me to my second part of the talk, journaling. I've been keeping a journal for 42 years and counting. Jenny makes these journals. I've got a group of them up here, five of them here, and you can look at them after the show. We're going to bring them out. Also a drawing that you can look at that's framed up. This is a place, this is my repository for ideas. This is where I do lots of studies. They're made of 90-pound arches, hot-pressed watercolor paper, perfect for painting watercolor on, and are taking all kinds of notes. I'm working on book 150 now. Book 150 is here. There's a lot of empty pages at the back of it. That's the way you'll be able to tell it when you get up here and look. The history of books in my life goes way back. One of my favorite memories is when I was a kid crawling up in my grandparents' bed and looking at the series of six books called My Book House. These were really a beautiful set of books of the golden age of American illustration worked on these. Joseph Chenoweth here on the left and N.C. Wyeth over on the right doing the covers. Inside, beautiful text and images. Don P. Crane, a lesser known artist of illustration here, did these. The sugar plum tree was a favorite, and I love the flow of the image, the accumulation of images on the eye as one page through the book. I also grew to like the way this artist used just a few colors and made it actually just sing. It's an amazing thing. In a funny way, the idea of making my own book house was probably at the bottom of making all these journals. I want to show you also how I use my journal to sort of plan out, map how I make my work. This is a work that I stopped in around 2007. It was about halfway done, and I decided to stop and make some sketches of it to figure out where I wanted to go. So here's one page from my journal, and I've sketched it out both in pen and in watercolor. You can find different elements with the different medium, playing with both of them. I mapped out the course that I wanted to go with the final work, which you see here. There's lots of writing in there, and the first question you're going to ask is, can I read it? And yes, I can, and we're going to talk about how that developed in just a few minutes. But the writing is essentially dreams. I find dreams a really wonderful way to keep a journal because I don't write them. They write me. I feel like they're the window to my subconscious, and I love to sort of sit back and look back on them and sort of figure out, what are all these symbols? How do they relate to my life? And I usually have a feeling somewhere in my life that relates directly to the dreams. I trained myself to remember my dreams. Actually, going to sleep, I started to say to myself, I'm going to remember my dreams. I'm going to remember my dreams. And then in the middle of the night, I'd roll over, and here's a little pad I have by my bed, and I'd write out, and as best I could, a couple of words that sort of relate to what was in the dream. So clam soup is here. I could barely, it took me a long time to read that. A lot of times I can't read what I wrote. But if I can, it's a real trigger. I can remember, clam soup, and a lot of people were coming over, and da-da-da. So I'll sit down and write out my dreams the first thing in the morning. It's a wonderful transition from that dream state into the workaday world. I usually get up very early. It's my body clock. I'm up by 3:30 in the morning, and I work, and I go back home, and I'm usually bed by 9:30, and I do that on the weekends as well, working into the day. It's just what I like to do. This is my first book. I graduated from University of Georgia, Athens, in advertising, or actually graphic design. I went to an ad agency, Atlanta, when I graduated in 1977 and immediately hated it. I was working 50 and 60-hour weeks doing work I did not care about, and I was losing my art. So I had met Jenny at University of Georgia. She came to me on my 23rd birthday, handed me this book that came right off the shelf and said, "Get your art together," and I did. And so I started working on this book in felt tip pen, and I made sketches of the landscape. I love the history of the landscape in America. Thomas Cole all the way down to Fairfield Porter. Edward Hopper said he wanted to paint the light on a house. Well, I saw that as a kind of cosmic event. You know, it took 8 seconds for that light to get to your eyes. That star is part of a local group of stars that are part of a Milky Way galaxy, that are part of a local group of galaxies. The light that we see is our link to the cosmos, and I feel like that any kind of light is a kind of beautiful poetry if we stop and look at it. So I was making sketches of the landscape, and I was also taking notes about what I did today. That was getting pretty boring by the time I got to Carnegie Mellon, where I was going for a master's in painting. So I started by opening a second journal and letting myself do anything I wanted to in that book. And one of the games was just to follow my train of thought. Can I follow it? It's very hard to do if you tried it, but if you do it, it's a good way of unlocking the words, letting them start to fall out. This was a game I had on a bus trip at night. Couldn't even see my hand. I was writing down all the things that I saw along the way. A little game, but it was a way of opening me up. The real leap for me came in between my 2 years of graduate school at Carnegie Mellon. I came to this auspicious institution and I worked as a summer guard. Yes, indeed, that is me with Ginevra da Vinci. And I got to know those paintings very well. Did you know you can see Leonardo's fingerprint right up under Ginevra's chin? He was actually learning how to paint an oil paint, and something new at the time, probably working it with his hands. I loved getting to know these paintings. The guy from the South coming in, I was like a kid in a candy shop. Well, at the same time, I also had in my hand an 8x10 sheet of paper folded up into 16ths, and every once in a while I would take a little train of thought note or take a little look at the painting, unfolded these at the end of the day. This was a way of unlocking my abilities as well, and at this point my drawing got small and it never got larger again. One of the tricks I also learned was working with a rapidograph pen. It's an old architect's drafting tool still around. Very temperamental, but I've managed to keep the number 2-aught and 3-aughts running enough so that they work for me. And you can see a mix of brown and black ink and just a little bit of distilled water, and it works beautifully, beautifully enough so that I could start making really fine copies of some of the masters. This is a copy, of course, after Albrecht Dürer's engraving, Melancholia I. The writing became more sort of sensitive to what I was writing about, little haiku phrases. By the time of the early 90s, I was starting to recognize that my dreams were important to me, and I would write down my dreams. These are two different dreams that were written down on that particular day in 1995, and I was working with watercolor wash, usually just black. I figured if I could learn how to handle value relative to light to dark, I could move to color later. And then I started working with my watercolor on in these books that Jenny's making me. And this is a general flow of the books these days. The dreams alongside these images, a sort of inside coming out in the dreams and an outside coming in through the watercolors. Two very different pictures, the flowing side by side, a picture of my life. Now let's move into printmaking. I love a particular kind of printmaking. These are three burnished mezzotint plates photographed on my studio table, and you can see they are basically copper. I love mezzotint because you don't use acid. It's all done at the table yourself. I roughen the plates and then smooth them, and then I ink them up, and the ink does not stick to the areas that have been smoothed. So the three plates that you see here have been printed when you see them here. And so the really rough parts print really dark, and the areas that have smooth print light. Now to do this, I rock it with a mezzotint rocker, a serrated knife which has little points at the end of it, and you rock it back and forth. A true mezzotint rocker does it straight across and then turns it 15 degrees, straight across, turns it 15 degrees, straight across, all the way 360, and then they do it again. Of course, using this small size plate, you can actually do that fairly quickly. And this is what it looks like in a photomicrograph. This is how I'm pitting the plate. And then here is a photomicrograph of a fully rocked mezzotint plate. And so what I'm doing is going around smoothing it and then looking close. The areas that have smoothed are here. They're showing a little lighter, and that will print gray. This will print black because there's a lot more texture there. So when I finish, I go to work with James Stroud of Center Street Studio in Milton, Massachusetts, who really has been my partner in printmaking for many years. Jim worked with Stanley William Hayter. He knows all the ins and outs of printmaking. I don't need to try to keep up with Jim. Jim tells me all the options I've got, and it's really fantastic to have a specialist like this on board. Jim tells me what kind of ink is possible here. How much oil should we add to it? How much pressure on the plate? How damp should we have the paper? What kind of paper should we use? Jim knows all these things, and he's a really technical expert. So when Jim provides expertise, it really matters. It really moves my work up a notch. And of course, printmaking can be a collaborative effort. And Jim certainly has been a wonderful collaborator. Here he is holding one of the plates in his hand. He's going to stick it on that press that you see behind him. He is going to put a piece of paper on it, and there's my wife, Jenny, holding the felt, keeping that felt from folding up over it. Of course, the felts are there to make it have an even pressure as he runs that plate with a piece of paper through the press, turns that beautiful circle, and out pops a print. And this is the moment of truth. You never know what is going to come out. Sometimes it's fantastic, like you never dreamed it would, and sometimes it's a mess and you got to start over. But that's the risk you take, and that's why printmaking is so exciting. Here's the final print. Printmaking cultivates outside forces that transform. Let me show you another print. One of the first prints I did was with Jim Stroud. It was with a drawing I did even before we moved in our house, a little rocking chair, barely, not even quite 5 inches tall. I said, Jim, let's make a print of this one. He sent me a plate. I didn't even ask him to chop it down to the size of the original drawing. I started burnishing, got to a certain point, and said, let's take a look at it. I sent him this plate. He stuck it on the press, printed it, and he sent me back with a one symbol note, exclamation point. And so I looked at it for a while. I actually put it up for several months because I couldn't believe that it actually worked like that. And there it was, the print. I actually decided that we should publish, and it was a very, very popular print that we did. Printmaking offers you results you can get no other way. This is an example of an aqua tint that I did with Jim Stroud. I have to go there to work with aqua tint because it does use acid. To make an aqua tint, you take that copper plate and you dust it with very fine particles of rosin, dried pine sap, very evenly ground. You heat that up, it affixes to the plate, and then you would then block it in other ways. Keep acid at bay. What I decided to do in this particular piece was to block it with just straight Karo syrup. And the little areas are white. I just painted clear Karo syrup on the surface of it. Then I mixed the dark Karo syrup with the acid and flooded that onto the surface. And what happened was all this little subtle gradation, the acid started eating into the clear Karo syrup, cutting into it, and making these very soft gradations. Gradations I've been trying for years to get in watercolor and can't do it. Here it is in aqua tint. Aqua tint is the only way you can do that. Here is a close-up of that aquatint plate with all those little raised islands of the rosin that have been cut into the plate with acid. And here's how the telltale look of an aquatint. Wonderful little granular kind of feeling to the whole thing. And printmaking invites the serendipitous. Let me show you a quick example of that. I was working on another piece from that portfolio. And as I was making the last pass, a drop of acid fell right on the upper left corner. I went, oh no, we're gonna do this over, aren't we? And then I ran to the sink, washed all the acid off, and Jenna said, let's print it anyway. Let's see what it looks like. And what happened was, all these beautiful little spots had happened, little bubbles almost, almost exploding outward like the comet even. Echoes of the stars, echoes of the comet. It became almost the centerpiece of the work. And so this was an accident, a happy accident caused by printmaking. Now, curating here at the National Gallery, there's lots of wonderful things I've learned about curating, especially doing my own exhibitions. I've worked with Bravin Lee Programs in New York, 4 shows with them, 3 shows with Gallery Joe in Philadelphia. Wonderful folks at both places that have been very supportive of what I do. I've learned how to put together a show for myself in a way that's been really very satisfying. But here at the National Gallery, one of the things that I love in particular about doing shows is you really get next to these aha moments that artists have. This Rauschenberg show had a real aha moment. His breakthrough piece, Accident. And because printmaking, you take states, you take these test prints, we have a record of what the print looked like early on in the work on the left here. And here, Rauschenberg had taken this large stone that had been ground very smoothly. That's what lithographs are made on. He was drawing on it with greasy ink and making the image and building in these various images he had taken from newspapers. And it was going fine. So he kept working on it. And then suddenly, as he took another proof, the stone cracked right through the center like that. Wow. And he said, I guess we're just going to have to start over. And they thought for a while and said, hey, wait a minute. No, let's print the print with the crack. And then any pieces that fall off a stone as we're printing, we'll stick them down here at the bottom of it. And we'll print a whole edition like that. So what Rauschenberg was doing was not only in 1963 bringing us out of abstract expressionism, the appreciation of pure gesture, but he was also bringing in popular culture, taking us into pop art by bringing in these images that you see around in the piece. And then he was bringing in a bit of conceptualism. Hey, the act of making a print can be a subject of the print as well. So Rauschenberg's aha moment was a great moment in his career. Printmaking allows us to watch an artist think. Here we see me in situ, the West Building Print Room, with one of the many classes that have come to see us. And here we see a group of George Bellows prints. I wish I could expound on these Bellows prints for a long time. Beautiful lithographs. I try to bring them out for the students often. They're wonderful examples. But what I'm going to do now is turn to another favorite, and we're going to look at a drawing where we see an artist thinking, really thinking. And here is Mary Cassatt. This is the front side and back side of a drawing. And you can see she was using this to make a design for a print. She originally thought that she might have 5 figures or maybe just 4. We don't really know, but there was a man seated in a top hat with a cane, and then in profile, a woman standing. But in the end, she decided to just transfer 3 of those figures on. We can see by the material that transferred from the plate as she traced it off here. And she used those outlines to start making the print. But that is a working drawing, and paintings and sculptures sculpture curators don't generally get to see this thing. The paintings are polished, they're finished, sculpture the same. We in prints and drawings really get to watch artists think, and that's why I love to show students this kind of work, because it really, it's the thought process that's quite visible. And here is the beautiful print. Of course, leaving out the figures allowed us to have this beautiful view across the River Seine in Paris, where Cassatt was working. Let's look at one more example of a series of proofs. We have 8 proofs for this particular print called Touched Red. I'm only going to show you 2 proofs in the final print, but yeah, you can see Richard Diebenkorn, California artist, is really working out a very difficult arrangement of balance in an abstraction with this. He starts off the print in black, and then he starts adding other colors by adding plates, actually. Each of these plates would have had a different color, would have had a different plate associated with it. So it looks easy, but it's actually a lot of work to do something like that. And he's actually adding little bits of collage as he's going. So these are working proofs. He's projecting where he's going. And this is a working proof 4, and this is the final print. And there is an amazing transformation in this. He's working out very subtle things in here, and because we have prints to back it up, we can see where his mind went. Here on the left is working proof 4, and on the right is the final print. And look, he transforms this white shape into a rectangle. He takes that red and turns it into a half arrow. He decides to add a little bit of green here, the complement to red, incidentally. He amps up the brightness of this yellow. He actually turns a bit of purple from the side that you see over here and brings it in over here. And all this noise, this gray and some of the red have been pushed way back, so it's open. This reminds me of something Rauschenberg said that Joseph Albers told him, I learned from his work, is that contrast equals interest. And I think that's what's going on here is Diebenkorn is working out the details, balancing contrast of color, line, form, as he's working his way through this print. And sometimes in prints and drawings, we just get to see an artist who's on fire. He's excited. And this is a work, one of my favorites in the collection, Oscar Blumner, a Stieglitz associate who spent 3 weeks going across Europe in the summer of July, in summer of 1912, traveling. And here you can see an amazing range of images. He's probably working with just the pen or pencil outlines as he's traveling by these sites and then going back and filling in color from memory. And he's also breaking into these wonderful little abstract elements. There's also a cinematic quality, the way they just keep flowing down the page. A really marvelous sketchbook and something that I've loved to look at and show students, because oftentimes they show up at our doorstep and say, I don't know, I don't want to work on my sketchbook. And I kind of remember that as a student. And this is a guy who really knows what he wants to do with his sketchbook. I love this page in particular, his little key of colors that he's seen along his trip. So let's talk a little bit about what I've learned here at the National Gallery. One thing about the creative process is summed up, it seems to me, by E. Cummings in this statement. Always the beautiful answer who asks a more beautiful question. It's why I work serially. You get to the end of a drawing, and you're thinking, hey, now wait a minute, I learned that. Let's move to the next thing. And then the next thing begets the next thing, and you get excited about the next thing. So you keep on and on. I'll show you another serial project that I want. Here I am sitting at my window with all my journal and materials. This is a drawing I did in 1993 to 1995. I remember Jenny walked out into the yard that spring day, grabbed a bunch of daffodils, brought them in, and stuck them in a black vase. There they were sitting in front of Burritt's Atlas of the Heavens, 2 pages that we had framed, a 19th century astronomical chart that has been on our wall since we moved into the house. I saw the daffodils, I saw those imported paper balls, and I flipped. I said, I gotta make a drawing of this. And I started working into it and finished it in a couple years, and then looked back and realized, hey, all those beautiful petals, they relate to the shapes of the star chart. And then even a little longer later, I realized that, oh yeah, 1994, that's when our daughter was born. That's the kind of symbology that is the best, that kind of comes back to you. It's kind of like it comes to you from my dreams. You don't figure out the symbols before, you recognize them afterwards. Here's a work that I just completed of the same subject. I worked on this drawing 13 years. It features one of Sam's little fans that she made in grade school. I worked on it so long that the fan and the watercolor faded. But I was again working with those cometary forms, this time in, of course, the wood grain of the chest, and then in the goldfish bowl, which had these very strange bending looks to them. Sometimes you want trouble to go away and it just finds you. Jenny bound me a bunch of books, or a couple of books recently. The sizing seemed to have gone bad. If you paint on a blotter which has no sizing, all the color sinks into it. Well, that's what was going on in these books. So I figured out, well, why don't I just draw on it in a pen that actually sits at the top? There are some pens with some kind of lacquer in it that will actually let me work onto the top of these. Then I started making copies after some of my favorite artists. Corot is an artist I go back to. And I returned to something I did much earlier, working in pen and ink. I actually started doing that in high school. And I got to dig into it in a way I hadn't done it before. So you just sort of take it and use it. This is a recent painting outside the book. It's about the size of the sheet of one of my drawings, or one of the sheets of my book. I have been mixing in just little bits of gum arabic, the binder in watercolor, adding touches of it, and sort of infusing kind of glaze on top of them with these fine brushes with a little bit of color. And so I've been working color this way. I also remember walking into the Luis Melendez show, an 18th century Spanish still life player, and seeing this painter and seeing this wonderful display about how he used brilliant color and then painted dark colors over. And I thought, what a wonderful idea. So I started doing that. So here's the street light. And I was painting fairly bright colors under it and then working it out. You can see on the left an earlier state, and then here's the finished state. I also remember very clearly when a former print and drawing conservator, Judy Walsh, called me over to a Turner watercolor and said, you know, Charlie, Turner always divides his paintings into three sectors, red, yellow, and blue, the primary colors. And I looked down at her and I looked back and I said, how did I never see that? But if you do look at Turner, go look at, because especially the later works, it's all red, yellow, blue, and that's why they are so intensely colored. So I have been trying to do a bit of that. This is a kind of fusion of some of my subject. I looked up one evening in the window and saw Burritt's Atlas of the Heavens tangled in the street light in twilight. And over a period of 4 years, I waited for that image to manifest itself while I painted it. And again, I divided it into the red sector, the yellow sector, and the blue sector, like Turner, trying on some of these ideas I learned at the gallery. Turn my head just a little bit, looking up the street, and I look in reflection into the next room and the house up the street. I was trying so hard to figure out what was wrong with this image in my sketchbook here. I was trying to figure out what was missing. My parents sent me a letter. It was just before Christmas, a rather large letter. I unthinkingly walked over and pinned it to the wall, and there it was. And I looked up and sat down to my studio and looked up, and there it was, just touching that light that had come on. And I thought, that's the answer. I think about that balance that Diebenkorn was trying to find, that looking for the interest, the contrast. That was exactly the right moment for me, and I moved on with the drawing. And then I come back to my tree, a tree I still see when I look out the window, even though it's not there. Still trying to grapple with it. That is the last drawing I ever did of the tree. You can see in a little close-up with that early drawing from 1987, 30 years later, that tree had grown to be quite a monster. But one thing that I have learned over the years, the great artists, they're always ready to move on, to use what happens. It's really summed up very beautifully in an idea by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Every wall is a door. Every obstacle, every descent into some kind of confusion can actually turn to your advantage if you actually are open to it. And so, what am I going to do with that great big piece of empty sky? Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.